Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Will we bid that apple and the garden?
Thank you, Pete Seeger, for that wonderful rendition, as usual, of the Solartopia song with David Burns and Dara Williams. This is Harvey Wasserman. This is another hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Today, we are playing a speech I gave on August 6th, 2014, this year's Hiroshima Day commemoration. I gave it at the Unitarian Universalist Meeting House in Berkeley, California. It runs for the full hour. And we cover the gamut, as you would expect, on a Hiroshima Day. I hope you enjoy the show. It was a fully packed house and a wonderful, wonderful audience. I was very privileged and happy to be there, as I am on PRN. So take a listen in. Thank you so much.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. From Fukushima to Solartopia, how the green-powered Earth Revolution can defeat King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas. Only someone who worked tirelessly to defeat nuclear power for over 40 years and has not stopped to this day, someone who lived and built a renewable energy utopia for the same 40 years, can take the frightening topic of Fukushima and give energy for a way out. Harvey Wasserman says that we are in the fight for our lives. We must and can build the green-powered Earth before the next nuclear meltdown. In this Hiroshima Day 2014 speech, he lays out that it can be done. Harvey Wasserman lived on an organic farm in Massachusetts when he and his community prevented a nuclear power plant from being built in the Montague Valley in 1973. In 1976, he helped organize the Clamshell Alliance. They staged the first mass demonstrations against the Seabrook nuclear plant. In 1979, he co-organized MUSE, the Musicians United for Safe Energy Concerts in Madison Square Garden. In 1994, he spoke for Greenpeace to 350,000 fans at Woodstock 2. To this day, Wasserman has investigated the nuclear industry and their meltdowns, from Harrisburg to Chernobyl and Fukushima. At the same time, he has taught history at Ohio colleges and has helped in successful campaigns to save a local wildlife refuge, shut a central Ohio trash-burning power plant, stop a regional radioactive waste dump, and ban McDonald's from his town of Bexley. Harvey Wasserman is writing articles for Counterpunch, The Huffington Post, and The New York Times. He's the author and co-author of a dozen books on nuclear history, war and peace, and renewable energy. Wasserman's Solartopia, Our Green-Powered Earth, is the first vision of a planet free from fossil and nuclear fuels. His website, solartopia.org, is the best link to his online activities and his weekly radio show on PRN, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I recorded Harvey Wasserman in the venerable meeting hall of the Unitarian Universalists Fellowship in Berkeley, California, on Hiroshima Day, August 6, 2014. Cecil Pineda, the Mexican-American author of Devil's Tango, how I learned the Fukushima step by step, gave him an eloquent introduction. Cecile Pineda.
It gives me great displeasure to have to introduce Harvey Wasserman to you. I wouldn't have to be doing it if Enrico Fermi hadn't split the atom in 1934. I wouldn't have to be doing this if 12 hyped-up mathematicians at Alamogordo hadn't worked developing what they cavaliered referred to at JET. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if nuclear energy couldn't be profitable unless it provided bomb-grade plutonium to the atomic weapons industry. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if there weren't 7,315 nuclear bombs currently in the U.S. arsenal. And if, in a nod to austerity, the Pentagon wasn't planning on a bargain basement nuclear war slated for 2016 targeting Russia and possibly China. I wouldn't have to introduce Harvey if human negligence, deliberate criminality, and utter disregard for its dangers, human activity hadn't allowed more than 330,000 metric tons of nuclear waste to proliferate all over the planet, with no technology in sight to sequester it from the biosphere. So, here we are on August 6, 2014, the 69th anniversary of the number one empires crossing the line in the sand and delivering the first two atom bombs on a civilian population. Although there were most likely more than just one smaller scale experiments conducted on its own people and in its own territories earlier, and many more would be scheduled later. So, let me stop here by sharing one small ray of light with you, this quote from Howard Zinn. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there's so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presence, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, it in itself is a marvelous victory. Harvey Wasserman has lived his life and dedicated his heart and mind to the spinning top for over 40 years. Please cheer this kind, compassionate, and courageous warrior, Harvey.
Harvey Wasserman began by extending personal greetings and thanks to Cecile Pineda and friends and fellow activists.
In my spare time, I edit a website called nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, which is supported by three of the greatest people that I've ever worked with, Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, and Graham Nash. And I'd like to give them a round of applause. I really appreciate it. So much in the anti-nuclear movement has happened because of them. Where I am here now is to tell you good news, and then bad news, and then really good news. Okay, so the good news is this. We're winning. We are definitely shutting down the nuclear power industry. It's definitely happening. From 1968 to 1984, I lived on a hippie farm in western Massachusetts. We had been there 5 years. We stopped burning the furniture. We figured out how to insulate the house and keep warm. And one day in December of 1973, the local utility company announced that they were going to build twin nuclear reactors 4 miles from our house. And in the local newspaper, there was an aerial photograph of the Montague Plains, which was where they were going to put it, and then they superimposed a sketch, an artist's rendering of these nuclear plants. And the minute I looked at this, and all of us, we all looked at it instantly and said, we are going to stop this thing, and we are going to end any idea that they're going to bring the bulldozers into the Montague Plains. Now, we were given zero chance to stop these guys. We were just a bunch of hippies on the hill. The utility had come into the town expecting no opposition whatsoever. I mean, it was going to be jobs, tax breaks, excitement, all that great stuff. And we just said, no, we're not going to do it. And so that's when I remember the night I coined the phrase, no nukes. And then this guy from my farm, Sam Lovejoy, knocked over a weather tower as a protest. Some of you may know about. We made films. We organized. We wrote books. Anna Georgie wrote a wonderful book called No Nukes. And we just kicked him right out of town. They never got the bulldozers in. You can go to the place where they were going to build this thing and just lie down, and it's perfectly quiet, and there are birds flying over, and it's next to the Connecticut River, and we just won. Now, in 1974, Richard Nixon, remember Richard Nixon? He announced in the middle of the Arab oil embargo that there would be 1,000 commercial reactors in the United States by the year 2000. 1,000. At the time he made this announcement, there were about 250 either online, under construction, or on order. And literally from the time he made that announcement, the numbers started to drop, largely because of our movement in two directions. One, because of our political opposition. We cut off funding from the federal government, most of the funding, actually, that they would have gotten. And also, we started promoting renewables. And I'm going to talk about that in greater detail. Because of our movement, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise, we cut the number down. They never got over about 120 in the United States, which is way too many, but still, it ain't 1,000. In the year 2000, there were 104, not 1,000. Today, there are 100. We shut four reactors last year, including two at San Onofre between LA and San Diego. A huge victory. And so one of the things I'm here to urge is that all Californians, and I'm actually becoming a Californian, we still have Diablo Canyon. We have two reactors at Diablo Canyon. And I want to let you know that there is a really nice place to stay in San Luis Obispo. It's the county jail. I did three nights there. I plan on doing more. Back in 1984, we were the late in the day affinity group, and you know that those reactors will be shut. But it should be the number one priority. People ask me in California, what can we do out here? Shutting Diablo Canyon is a huge deal. It is in a tsunami zone, and it is surrounded by earthquake faults. It's the job of an organizer to make sure that people understand that you can win, and we've been winning for more than 40 years. Actually, in slowing this industry down. And I want to acknowledge one of the great heroes of our movement. I talked to Dennis about him on the radio today. A Bay Area, he wasn't a native, he was from Cleveland, but he lived out most of his life on Clayton Street in San Francisco, Dr. John Goffman. Dr. Goffman was at Lawrence Livermore. He was a genius, if there ever was one. Deserved two Nobel Prizes. He did some of the major pioneering work in LDL cholesterol. I never knew that until after he passed away. But he was also part of the Manhattan Project, and he co-discovered some of the isotopes that made nuclear weapons, unfortunately, and nuclear power possible. And he became the chief health officer of the Atomic Energy Commission. And in one of the most important acts of defiance and truthiness, I guess, as Stephen Colbert would say, in our history, I got to tell this story because, you know, this is Hiroshima Day. This is a major turning point. And very few people understood that commercial reactors could harm people back in the late 1960s, early 70s. But another great hero, and this man is still alive, Dr. Ernest Sternglass, was a radiologist at the University of Pittsburgh. And he got in the mail anonymously records of the radiation emissions from the Shippingport commercial reactor, which was the first to open in the world, actually, in 1957. And being a radiologist, he understood. He looked at the numbers, and he realized that Shippingport, even though it didn't have an accident, was killing people. He wrote a book called Secret Fallout, which was pulped, by the way. There, some very strange things happened to the copies of Secret Fallout. So when this came out, it was a big scandal, a big deal. And by the way, Ernie single-handedly, in many ways, stopped the anti-ballistic missile system. This was in the late 60s. our plan, the genius American plan, was to put nuclear-tipped missiles around all of our cities. And if nuclear-tipped missiles were coming in, we would shoot nuclear-tipped missiles up and we would blow them up. And that was going to save us, right? So Ernie pointed out a small detail that if you did that, there'd be so much radiation that every child in the United States would basically keel over dead. And the article was published in Esquire, and actually it's generally credited with having turned Congress against the ABM system. And so when Ernie came out again and said that the nuclear power plants were going to harm people, or were harming people, they assigned Dr. Goffman, who was as prestigious a scientist as there was in the world, with his tremendous credentials from the Manhattan Project and all that other stuff. He was a medical doctor as well as a nuclear chemist. The head of the chief of the safety division of the Atomic Energy Commission, they said, go deal with this guy, expecting him to exonerate the nuclear industry. To John's everlasting credit and to the importance of our movement, he came back and said, well, you know, we've looked at this. He had a co-researcher named Arthur Tamplin from the RAND Corporation. They basically found out that nuclear power plants, without an accident, and with far fewer, far smaller reactors than we have today, were killing 32,000 Americans a year. Now, the AEC wanted none of this, and they basically forced him out. They couldn't fire him. He was too prestigious. But they put him in a closet, basically. They took away his staff. They took away his funding. He published a book called Poisoned Power, which was fittingly published by the Rodale Press, the organic gardening and farming people. And we read Poison Power on our farm. And John, by the way, stuck with it for the rest of his life. I mean, he was unrelenting and absolutely an essential piece of the no nukes movement. When he was asked what he thought of the nuclear power industry, remember, this is a guy at the top of the heap. He characterized nuclear power, and I quote, as premeditated mass murder. That's what he called the commercial atomic reactor industry. Now, when they came into our town to build this reactor, these two reactors, unfortunately, we already had an expert on the farm about nuclear power, which was me, because I had done a report on it in ninth grade, so I knew everything about atomic reactors, and I had got it out of our friend the Atom by Walt Disney, so good credible source there. But then we turned to John, we turned to Ernest, we turned to other sources, and we realized that atomic energy was already a failure, was killing people, was endangering people. All you really have to know about atomic power is that they can't get private insurance. Since 1957, I'm sure I'm not telling you anything most of you don't know, if there's an accident at a commercial reactor, the owners are not liable. How do you expect any safety, any public awareness, any public compliance from an industry that is not liable for what they do? And we're seeing this play out right now at Fukushima. Tokyo Electric Power Company built Fukushima. They own Fukushima. And they blew up Fukushima, all four reactors. And they still own Fukushima. We circulated a petition. I circulated this last summer and fall to go to the United Nations and ask the United Nations to set up a separate body to take over Fukushima and to put the experts there who could really clean this place up. We got 150,000 signatures. Move On helped, and Roots Action, and the Green Shadow Cabinet, and Greenpeace, and a few other organizations, 150,000 signatures. We took these signatures to the UN on November 7th last year. We have yet to get a reply. We have not heard a word from the United Nations. But the reality is that TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, has no liability in this situation. Not only don't they have any liability, they're making money on this. Last year, Tokyo Electric Power showed a huge profit, mostly based on government money coming in to pay them to clean up the mess they made, of which they're completely incapable of doing. So let's talk about this. I'm going to go into the difficult phase of this talk. We'll get it out of the way, okay? And we generally, I pass out Prozac and Zoloft and other things to, but you know, this is hard stuff, and I'm just gonna have to tell you what's going on at Fukushima. It's not pretty, and it's very, very disturbing, but it's what we have to deal with, okay? So there were six reactors at Fukushima, 54 in Japan total. And the six reactors were very strongly opposed by the Japanese people. I was in Japan when they were building these reactors. I actually wrote an article that appeared in the Progressive magazine in 1977 about Fukushima. Not because I had any great sight wisdom, but people were marching. They said, what are you doing building commercial reactors in an earthquake zone washed over by tsunamis, which is, of course, a Japanese word. And they did every imaginable idiotic thing that you could, starting with the fact that the site where Fukushima was built had an 85-foot bluff on it. You know, 85 feet is a pretty decent, it's good to be above the sea level 85 feet if you got six commercial reactors that could be washed over by a tsunami, right? What did they do? They took down the bluff because they didn't want the expense of pumping the seawater up 85 feet. So instead of sitting on the earth and operating these reactors in the air, which still would have been better, they just brought them down to sea level. And then they put the backup power source in the basement. Now, they built a flood wall, but there was historic data that the flood wall, that tsunami barrier was not high enough, that there had been historically tsunamis bigger than that. And the bottom line is this, that they put this thing right in harm's way. What has happened? Well, first of all, it may be that the earthquake itself caused the meltdowns anyway without the tsunami. This was a 9.0. It was a 9.0 120 kilometers away. God forbid it had been 12 kilometers away or 1.2 kilometers away, we would have had a pile of radioactive rubble. There would have been absolutely nothing that could have been done about it. And that could happen at Diablo Canyon. It could happen at Indian Point. Indian Point in New York is actually more susceptible, apparently, to earthquake than Diablo Canyon. And also, and this is the kind of thing you really think about, many of our commercial reactors in this country are downriver from large dams. And these dams are susceptible to earthquake damage, among other things. We have a dam upriver from the three reactors at Oconee in South Carolina, which has a 65-foot crack in it. And it is clear that if that, God forbid, that dam broke, the wall of water would exceed the tsunami that hit Fukushima in size. We've already had a reactor at Fort Calhoun, which we now call Port Calhoun, in Nebraska, which was flooded by the Missouri River a few years ago. So we've had experience with this already. This is not good news. At Fukushima, units 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, this is American technology. These are Mark I General Electric reactors. For more than 40 years, the nuclear power industry has been telling us that no commercial reactor can explode. Okay? Now, we had an explosion at Three Mile Island. We don't know how big it was, actually. And I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to tell a little aside here. At Three Mile Island, and this is part of our activist community here, at Three Mile Island there was a woman. When they built Unit 2, she got it in her brain that she was going to demand that the containment at Three Mile Island be able to withstand a jet crash. When you fly into Harrisburg, you fly right around this thing. She fought and fought and fought, and she won. She forced them to make the TMI containment dome the strongest one in the United States. And you know what happened? When the meltdown occurred, which they denied, by the way, they denied for years there was a meltdown of fuel. When the hydrogen explosion happened, it was almost entirely contained, thank God, by the containment dome. And we don't know to this day whether or not that woman had saved all of the northeast of the United States by forcing that containment. So don't ever think that this small deal that you're doing here or there, you know, doesn't have an impact. Chernobyl, they told us when Chernobyl finally did explode, they said, well, doesn't matter, that's a Soviet reactor, it couldn't happen in the United States. Now, let me tell you about Chernobyl. Chernobyl, you know, they put a sarcophagus over it. That thing is falling apart. They're trying to do another sarcophagus, another containment lid on it. It's the biggest structure ever made, biggest structure ever made by human beings. They're going to try and roll it on there on railroad tracks. You know, it's going to be happening over the next couple of years. Meanwhile, this thing is still putting out radiation. And we'll talk about the health effects in a minute. We'll do the engineering first. So then comes Fukushima. And after all these years of hearing of American reactors can't explode, four of them exploded. Those are General Electric reactors. Units 1, 2, and 3, the core was in there. And all three of these reactors, all three of them melted into the ground. We don't know where they are. Now, this is my 41st year of fighting nuclear power. Nowhere before 2011 did we hear anything about multiple meltdowns. People always say, well, what if a commercial reactor melts? What if three melt, for God's sakes? They don't know where these cores are after all these years. And so what's happening is Fukushima is on the coast, and then you have the ocean, and then, as in virtually all of Japan, you have steep mountains. And, of course, water pours down the steep mountains on a regular basis. So you have essentially a river running through Fukushima. It's running by these reactor cores and becoming irradiated and pouring into the Pacific Ocean at the rate of 300 tons a day, and has been doing that since 3/11/11. There's no end in sight. The latest genius move that they've made, I'm sure you've all heard about, they want to build an ice wall, right? They want to stick freezer coils into the ground and have a frozen wall between the mountains and this river, and then divert the river around the reactor core. So far, they've got it all the way down to 57 degrees, and they've created a giant radioactive slushy over there. You know, they'll probably dump big cherry flavoring on it and just have a party. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's never going to work. And they were advised, by the way, early on to dig a trench and put in a special radiation absorbent material by Arne Gunderson. They wouldn't do it because they said it cost too much. So now we have 300 tons of radioactive water pouring into the Pacific every day. And it may be detectable in California this summer, fall, we don't know. It is literally insane what they're trying to do there. And that's only part of it. Now, let's do more. The four explosions of Fukushima, units 1, 2, 3, and 4. In unit 4, the core had been lifted out before the tsunami came and before the earthquake hit. I mean, they were doing routine maintenance. Now, I couldn't make this up. In the General Electric Mark I reactors, the spent fuel pool is 100 feet in the air. Should I repeat that? Yeah. In the General Electric Mark I reactors, the spent fuel pool is 100 feet in the air. I can't even begin to think what the way these guys were thinking. The reality is now you have a whole reactor core at Unit 4 up in the air. They have to get these down. But the fact is that they've been pulling these rods out, and now they say they're taking a three-month break. We think that they can't get them out. Stand to reason that some of them have warped and that there's debris in the pool. We don't know. We can't find out at this point in time. It's not a happy picture. And then units 1, 2, and 3 are also going to have, those spent fuel pools are also going to have to be emptied. God forbid they should lose coolant to one of those fuel rods. There's actually more radiation in the fuel pools than there is in the cores themselves. Okay, so that's the situation there. In 1956, one of the great heroes, one of my great heroes, and I was lucky enough to meet her once, Dr. Alice Stewart, was a British doctor, a British MD, and she undertook quite innocently to do a study of the childhood leukemia rates among British children. And she had a whole laundry list of possible factors that she checked out in an epidemiological manner. And one of the factors was x-raying women while they're pregnant. And that's the one that jumped out. And she realized in 1956 that there's essentially no safe dose of radiation, certainly not for a human fetus or an embryo, because if a single x-ray to a pregnant mother can double the childhood leukemia rate, you know, what are we talking about? So we have known since the 1950s that there's no safe dose of radiation. And so at Fukushima, the radiation releases have been horrific. We don't know exactly how much went out. We don't know exactly what its composition is, what the different isotopes are. We have a rough idea. And we don't know where it went. And we don't know, of course, who has been impacted. I have had, unfortunately, direct experience with this at Three Mile Island. At Three Mile Island, the utility company proudly announced that the amount of radiation released at Three Mile Island was, for everybody in central Pennsylvania, the equivalent of a single x-ray, as if this was a good thing. Of course, they never talked about Dr. Stewart's findings about how many pregnant women got this x-ray. But the fact is, it's utter nonsense. Radiation coming out of nuclear plants is random. It comes out down in clumps. We saw in central Pennsylvania, we saw whole neighborhoods where every house had cancer. I mean, every house. And then a neighborhood a mile away had nothing, because that's just the random way that radiation comes down. We saw this again at Chernobyl. And by the way, whenever you hear them somebody saying that nobody died at Three Mile Island, do something nonviolent, okay? Because it's one of the worst lies ever told in history. I went into the Central Pennsylvania a year after the accident. I may have been the only journalist stupid enough to do that. I sat and I interviewed people. It was the worst week of my life. You know, every disease you never want to hear about. I guarantee you, hundreds of people were killed at Three Mile Island. Chernobyl, the same thing, although worse. Chernobyl was much worse. The radiation came down all across Europe and all through Belarus and Ukraine. And I'm going to say something now, which is one of the worst things I've ever had to say. There are areas in Belarus and Ukraine where 20% of the children are healthy. 20% of the children are healthy. Some of you, I'm sure, have seen the pictures of the mutations and all that stuff. It's just beyond tragedy. And I will say, there has been a study done by three scientists, one of whom has passed away. They were Russians, and they compiled this 5,000 studies that were done around Chernobyl and have concluded that more than 1 million people have died as a result of Chernobyl. Now, in Fukushima, it's only 3 years out. The one thing the nuclear industry has been really, really good at over the decades is not studying the impacts of nuclear power. And they did a great job at Three Mile Island. They're doing following up very well at Chernobyl and at Fukushima. To their chagrin, there is a private university, the Fukushima Medical University. It's funded largely by the government, but they have been doing studies. They're following the health of about 400,000 children in the Fukushima area. So 3.5 years out, we now have a 40 times thyroid cancer rate among children. 40 times. Just about half of these 400,000 children have thyroid abnormalities. I wrote a piece about this, by the way. It was called Fukushima's Children Are Dying. It's at nukefree.org. I have not seen a rebuttal, which to me indicates that this is real, and they don't want to do a rebuttal because they can't deny this. And it's horrifying. I also want to mention, by the way, the guy, and I'm sorry I can't pronounce his name, the man who ran Fukushima, the plant manager. If there's ever a single human being to save millions of lives, it's this guy. He refused to leave during Fukushima. He was ordered to leave, and they were ordered to do a whole bunch of stuff and basically to abandon the plant. And this one guy refused to do it, and he probably saved millions of lives. And he has since died of esophageal cancer, unfortunately. And, of course, the owners of the plant say it had nothing to do with Fukushima. So the reality is that, and this is actually the worst thing I'm going to have to say, is that I am terrified of the water pouring into the Pacific Ocean. You know, this is cesium and many other highly lethal isotopes. And the question is not, are these isotopes potentially dangerous to human life? Of course they are. We know that now. They tested 15 tuna that were caught off the coast of California. All 15 of them showed cesium from Fukushima. It can be traced. So, you know, the industry says, well, it's not enough to harm you. We know it's enough to harm us. Come on. But beyond that, we have to wonder what this radiation is going to do to the ecosystem of the Pacific Ocean. Is it going to bioaccumulate? What will it do to the algae? What will it do to the phytoplankton, to the starfish, to the sea lions, to the herring, to the salmon? This is an apocalyptic consideration, and I don't have an answer for it. I think the only thing we can do at this point in time about Fukushima is to continue to pressure some kind of global response. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power, should not continue to own Fukushima. They do not have the expertise. They don't have the incentive. There's, you know, these are corporations we're dealing with. If there's a single virus that has infected and threatened the human race, it is the corporation. This entity, this entity that has been given human rights but no human responsibilities. There is no built-in financial incentive for Tokyo Electric Power Company to clean up Fukushima. As far as they're concerned, they could stay there forever and make money on it, you know, as they did in 2013. I think they made about $8 billion in 2013. They still own Fukushima. They still have no clear interest as a corporation in cleaning it up. They have no liability. They have no damages they'll have to pay to the people downwind who are harmed. That's not sustainable. And it's true of all the reactors in the world. And so that, more than anything, is what we really have to change. I believe we can change it. Why? Because our survival is at stake. If there's one thing that is more powerful than the profit motive, it's the survival instinct. What else do we need to know? You know, what more can go wrong? So, okay, so that's the hard news. That's the real. So all of you, I hope you're not depressed. I don't know how I continue to do this every day, but I have hope. Because, if, you know, we're informed now, we know what to do. Okay, so the good news. There is actually good news from Fukushima. One piece of good news, which is a big deal. As I mentioned, when Fukushima blew up, there were 54 commercial reactors licensed to operate in Japan. Does anybody know how many commercial reactors are now operating in Japan?
Zero.
None. Not one. No, they haven't reopened. Not. They've been licensed, but they haven't reopened. It is the biggest single mass shutdown of commercial reactors in the history of the world. We need more of that. There were about 440, roughly, commercial reactors worldwide on 3/11/2011. There are now around 360, 70, 80, something like that. So now, as we move ahead into the good stuff, we do have a rapidly diminishing number of commercial reactors in the world. It is happening. We shut, like I say, 5 last year. This year, Vermont Yankee will shut. There's no doubt about it. And all the reactors in the United States are old, and they are losing their competitiveness. The Mark I's, there's 23 General Electric reactors. There's a lot of old Westinghouse reactors. We have reached the tipping point. We actually reached it in 2011, where wind and solar are cheaper than operating nuclear plants. That's a huge deal. It means you now can put in solar panels and put nuclear power plants, existing nuclear power plants, fully amortized nuclear power plants, out of business. There was a very obscure but a very key reactor that went down. It's called Kewaunee, Kewaunee, in Wisconsin. And Kewaunee had not much really of an opposition. It's up way up near Green Bay, where I own part of the football team, by the way. there you go. You know what I'm talking about. Okay. And they didn't have any major structural problems. It was just old, and it was no longer efficient, and they shut it. They couldn't get anybody to buy it, and the owners just shut it. We have dozens of reactors on the brink of that now, all across the United States, especially in Illinois. You know, Obama's from Illinois, and he was with Commonwealth Edison, which turned into Exelon. If anybody can tell me why so many utilities names sound like laxatives, I'd really like to know that. So this is Exelon, and they have a dozen reactors, and this is Obama's roots. And they are now going, talk about chutzpah, they're going into the Illinois legislature, and they're saying, we need money to continue to operate these fully amortized reactors because they fight global warming. Now, we may lose a couple of those battles. You know, Nebraska, Texas, maybe a few other states will lose, and they'll get some subsidies for a while. But Massachusetts, other states, we should win. It may even come up here. Diablo is not quite at that state yet, but it may even come up in California where they start to ask for subsidies to operate these reactors. But if we can keep them from getting them, they will shut. Now, the other good thing that came from Fukushima, it's hard to say that, good thing coming from Fukushima, is Germany. There's been, for many years, a very powerful anti-nuclear movement, a pro-green movement in Germany. A lot of strength. And they actually forced, a number of years ago, a national decision to phase out all their nuclear plants. But then, politics being what there is, the center-right government came in for other reasons, and they stalled. It stalled. But the anti-nuclear movement, the way it happened in 2011, called for a giant national rally to force, finally, these reactors shut. There are 19 in Germany. And in between the calling of the rally and the rally itself, Fukushima happened. Now, Angela Merkel, the prime minister of Germany, is actually a chemist. And she after Fukushima said, we can't do this anymore, and she basically went along. And so Germany is now in the process of shutting all of its 19 reactors. 8 went down almost immediately after Fukushima. You have to remember, by the way, that Germany got heavily dosed by Chernobyl. It's a huge amount of radiation. They were not happy about it, and that's one of the reasons they got as far as they did. And so Germany shut the 8, and they're phasing out the other 11 by 2022. I think it's going to go faster. But what's really happening now in Germany, and I'm sure many of you know this, is there is a huge, very conscious, very powerful transition, national transition, being made to renewable energy, primarily solar and wind. This decision had to be agreed to by the major corporations in Germany. While most people were concerned, of course, about the health and all that stuff, the corporations think about profit, and the corporations came in Germany, Siemens most importantly, came to the conclusion that they could go with wind and solar and make more money. So this is happening. It's called Energiewende. I'm sure I butchered that. Anybody in Germany who speaks German can correct me. But the reality is that it is hugely successful. Now, when we first started fighting nukes back in the 70s, people would say to us, well, you want to stop nukes, what are you going to do for the power? And we'd say, solar, wind. We had no idea what we were talking about. But there was, thankfully, a Toward Tomorrow fair that was held in Amherst, Massachusetts in 1975. And there are two guys there, very important. One was named William Hieronymus. William Hieronymus, who's since passed away, had this vision of these huge windmills offshore. And everybody laughed at him like he was Gyro Gyros. They were going to be 5-megawatt windmills. And he had the drawings and the whole deal. And they poo-pooed him. They're happening now. General Electric is making 5-megawatt windmills to go offshore. One of the major costs on offshore windmills is getting the post into the ground, right? You got to go through all that water. But his vision had them floating. They were anchored to this ocean, but with chains, not with with posts. And if they can do that, you know, it's going to take off. The other guy at the conference of great importance was this little guy named Amory Lovins. Anybody heard of Amory Lovins? Amory Lovins is the great guru genius of renewable energy. I love him dearly. I've known him since 75. And he made all sorts of crazy predictions. He said somewhere in the 90s or early 2000s, there'll be hybrid cars. Who could imagine that in 1975? Hybrid cars. Can you believe that? And if you're interested, I really highly recommend Rocky Mountain Institute, rmi.org. And everything Amory says is 100% true. He is totally reliable. And he built a house in Snowmass, Colorado, where it's really cold outside of Aspen, and it has no heating unit. It's just totally solar heated. He has banana trees in his living room. So this all, back then we had a vision. I actually came up with a name for it in 2005, Solartopia, a totally green-powered Earth. We talked about it in 75. It was actually coming on in 76, 77, 78 when Carter came in. Carter had his faults, but he did have a vision of green power, and he did set up the National Renewable Energy Lab. And then the apocalypse occurred named Ronald Reagan. And anybody want to doubt the damage done by Ronald Reagan, I can tell you that he set us back a good 20, 25 years on renewable energy. There's absolutely no doubt about it. You know, ripping the solar panels off the roof of the White House was the least of what Reagan did, as did George Duke Majan here in California. It's horrifying what they did. And luckily for us, and it's hard for many Americans to understand this, there are other countries in the world. And the technology was picked up by Denmark and, you know, Danish, and the Japanese did a lot of solar, the Israelis did a lot of solar, and then the Germans, although the Germans basically took over Denmark's technology. And so where we had, with Jerry Brown, 17,500 windmills in California in the early 1980s, I knew Jerry Brown back then, by the way. I haven't seen him since. I have this vision of walking up to Jerry Brown and saying, Jerry, last I saw you were governor of California. What are you doing now? But anyway, he did a great thing, by the way. And I think I got a call on this. When they first put up the windmills here, they put up a bunch at Altamont Pass, right? You all know where Altamont Pass is. Those were bad windmills. They were small. They were fast. They killed a ton of birds. And, you know, it proved that if you really work at it, you can kill birds with windmills. The big windmills, they don't kill birds, maybe one a year. Your car kills more birds than the average commercial windmill. But the ones at Altamont Pass were really bad. They were in a migrating zone. They had latticed tower and fast blades. And so then the opponents of wind power would take the numbers of birds killed at Altamont Pass and spread that out over all the windmills in the world and prove that windmills would kill every bird on Earth. So when Jerry came back in, to his credit, he got those windmills down. They are putting up better windmills out there. So it proves that, you know, not everything we do that's green is 100%. We have to be careful about this. I will tell you right now, the photovoltaic cells, PV, the panels that convert sunlight to electricity, will be the biggest industry in the history of the world. There will be photovoltaic cells on every structure on this planet. There will be photovoltaic cells on every automobile, every vehicle, every device, every computer. Everything will have photovoltaic cells. Yeah, maybe even our false teeth. Well, that would be a good one. So, but, you know, it will be there, and it's on its way. The major decision we face actually in the world right now is by far the highest number of projected commercial atomic reactors are slated for China. It's about 36 on the drawing boards in China. And no one else is even close. I don't think anybody else is in double figures even. Russia and India, I think they're both under 10. And nobody else. The French are done. We're done. They're now on the brink of opting to go totally solar. And don't think that there's not a grassroots movement in China. There's a lot going, a lot of power. A lot of, you know, they had a revolution not too long ago. And there's a lot of grassroots opposition to nuclear and to pollution in China. So whatever we can do to urge the Chinese on, we need to do. It will happen. I also want to mention hemp. And for that, I'm going to put on my final T-shirt tonight. This is the favorite T-shirt I ever did. This is Pot-Smoking Patriots. This is George Washington, Ben Franklin, and Tom Jefferson all smoking marijuana, which is highly credible, actually. George and Tom both raised prodigious quantities of hemp. They raised a lot of tobacco. They hated tobacco is really hard to grow. They didn't like tobacco at all. But George imported large quantities of seed from India, and Tom just wrote about how much he loved raising hemp. And hemp was the number two cash crop in America before and during and immediately after the American Revolution, number one being tobacco, which was the more dangerous drug. So now with the prohibition on marijuana finally starting to end, hemp will come in. And hemp will be a much larger cash crop than marijuana ever was. And it'll be multi-billion. Ben Franklin is on here because his first paper mill used hemp paper. So we will have hemp, paper, clothing, bird seed, of course, oil, food. And so as prohibition goes away, it will impact the renewable energy industry. We also will have biofuels. Let me talk about biofuels very quickly, and I'm going to wind down here after we get through Solartopia. Biofuels are an extremely important part of the renewable energy mix. But we cannot make biofuels from corn and soy. It makes no sense whatsoever. We cannot use food crops to make fuel. We can't have people competing with hunger against automobiles. And plus, they're lousy sources of ethanol anyway. Corn is bad for ethanol, and soy is a little better for diesel fuel, but we need to use hemp oil and other forms, other crops. But biodiesel, biofuel will be very important. We will also have wave energy. And wave energy is one of my favorite. They basically take a giant metal sausage and they have it split in the middle and they go up and down and it squishes water and creates energy. We also have essentially underwater windmills. There's one off in Norway, and it's way more powerful than wind-driven windmills. Wind is irregular. Water and currents are way more powerful and way more reliable. And if we can solve the problem of corrosion from salt, those will be very big. You'll have them off the coast. We'll have them off the coast here. We also have ocean thermal. We have geothermal and mass transit God willing, we'll finally get some mass transit in this country, and increased efficiency, conservation, things like that. So to conclude with that part of it, we are on the brink of what I consider the most important technological revolution in human history, which is the conversion from King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to Solartopia, a totally green-powered Earth. We have the technology, and it's economical. That's the turning point that we face now, that we welcome now. All these technologies, which were once pie in the sky and which were considered too expensive, are now cheaper. They're cheaper than coal. They're cheaper than oil, for God's sakes, and they're cheaper than nukes. The only thing competing with renewables now is fracked gas. And fracked gas is a nightmare, as I don't have to tell you all. And I just want to conclude by saying, as we go to Solartopia, as we go to a green-powered Earth, and as we win this, and we are winning it, now I'm in the position of telling you that perhaps our number one ally in the conversion to Solartopian technology is Wall Street. Thank you. Because, you know, there is a faction in Wall Street that's invested in fossil and nuclear fuels, but it is shrinking radically. The big money is going into renewables. So the bottom line is this. We are on the brink now. And in my world, I live my life every day praying that we get to Solartopia before the next meltdown. It is a race. And so as we move to Solartopia, let's move to good-paying jobs. Let's move to a social justice situation, which is so much a part of this whole tradition here, this meeting house and this wonderful group of people. And just take heart in all the progress we've made, and remember that our survival is at stake here, as well as our economy. And let's move it. So, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was the conclusion of a speech by Harvey Wasserman on how the green-powered Earth revolution can defeat King Kong. Coal, oil, nukes, and gas. I recorded him in Berkeley, California, on August 6, 2014. In over 40 years of anti-nuclear activism and green, renewable energy practice, Wasserman has authored and co-authored a dozen books, countless articles for publications from Counterpunch to the New York Times. He teaches college-level history, does a weekly radio show on PRN, and has an active presence on the Internet that you can access through his website, solartopia.org. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation on TUC's website keeps this program on the air. That's tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gleiden. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this speech. This was at the Hiroshima Day commemoration at the Unitarian Meeting House in Berkeley, California. I want to thank Maria Gilardin and WTUC Radio. She did a fabulous job of recording this talk. It was a wonderful evening. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show for another scintillating hour of discussing the future of the human race. Thank you again to the crew in New York. And we'll see you again next week.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost. And so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The the fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia, solar-topia.
The nuclear plants were built in haste, with too many risks and no place for waste. And so from Seabrook to Shoreham Town, we have to shut those new plants down. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia, solar-topia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia all over God's
fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia, solar-topia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia all over God's green world. Solar-topia, don't you know we're